might and merciful God, from whom comes all counsel, wisdom, and understanding. We humbly ask you to guide and assist us in our deliberations and in our work. May all our efforts be directed to the welfare and good of our community and our country. May we act honorably in pursuit of true justice for all our people, now and for the future, and for generations still to come. Amen. Meeting of Parliament, Friday 10th March 2017. Order proceedings. Confirmation of the minutes. The minutes of the last meeting of Parliament, which was held on the 13th, 15th, and 20th of February 2017. May I sign the minutes as correct? Communications from the floor. As honourable members are aware, it is a requirement under Section 69 of the Constitution that the estimate of expenditure for the next financial year should be tabled in the House before the 30th of April. Since the House is not meeting its next month, I am proposing that the provisions of the Constitution will be deemed to have been met if the estimates are circulated to all honourable members before the end of April. This is what I've been doing for the last few years, and so I propose that that should be the case again this year. Is that agreed? There is another matter that I wish to refer to. In last Friday's edition of the Gibraltar Chronicle, it is reported that when asked how he had found his first year as an MP, the Honourable Mr. Clinton said, and I quote, "There is no manual that you get given, or even an induction course into Parliament. You get shown your feet, and you get shown your microphone, but that's about it." Now, while it is true that there is no induction course as such for newly elected members, it is not the case that the only guidance and assistance of the new cohort of members who were elected in November 2015 to see was just as described by the honourable member. Honourable members will understand that it is incumbent upon me that I should set the record straight. At the ceremonial opening of Parliament on the 9th of December 2015, I assured new members that they would always find me, the clerk, and the staff at their disposal in order to help them in the exercise of their important duties. Most of them, if not all, in fact, took up this offer prior to the first working meeting of Parliament in January 2016. To that end, the clerk and I and the staff met with them and explained to them not just the procedures of parliamentary meetings, but also the technical arrangements for the broadcasting of proceedings. Later, once they had received the draft estimate of expenditure at the end of March 2016, we held other separate meetings with them at which we explained the salient aspects of that special meeting, which is the budget session of Parliament. Since elected, the Honourable Mr. Clinton in particular has had a number of meetings with the clerk and myself at which we have given him every possible assistance which he has requested, including more recently the procedures for the introduction of private members' bills and petitions to Parliament. In the absence of any clarification from the Honourable Member since his remarks were published last Friday, I feel compelled to draw attention to what I consider to be unfair, implied criticism of the Clerk of Parliament to spot and my face. A full record. As you know, I didn't meet yourself and the clerk at 10:30 this morning to try and understand what your issue was with the Chronicle article on Friday. It is rather regrettable that we could not see eye to eye on it, and you made the statement you had. I stand by what I said in the Chronicle article, and it is regrettable that you seem to make the statement you had. Having said that, may I ask the speaker if he has had time to consider the contents of my letter to the 4th of February in relation to the application of Standing Order 4712? No, you will do no such thing. I don't think that you have had an opportunity, having heard my communication from the chair, we are going to move on to the next item. If you wish to take up any other matter with me, you can write to me about it. Mr. Speaker, with respect, I did ask you in my letter to actually make reference to it in the reference in the chair, and if I gathered what you're saying is that you have chosen not to do so. I'm referring to a matter which has got nothing to do with it, and therefore this is not the appropriate time at which to raise it. The matter that you are referring to is not connected with the communication from the chair, with the statement that I have felt compelled to make. It's got nothing to do with it.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, frankly, your earlier statement, I think, had nothing to do with the proceedings of Parliament. I've actually written to you.
The Honourable Member, it has a lot to do, not just with the proceedings of Parliament, but with which the manner in which members of Parliament conduct themselves, not just within Parliament, but outside. I would commend the Honourable Member that he reads through the Parliament Act. In particular, reference is to criticism of the Speaker, where that is not justified. Now, if he wishes to continue to contest the matter, I will allow him. But ultimately, he knows what the rules are, and ultimately, what I say remains said. It's on the record, and that's all that is true. I have given the Honourable Member an opportunity. He met me this morning, and he remains intransigent. So be it. I have had my say, and that goes on the record, because there are aspects that he needs to understand. Respect for the Speaker, respect for the institution that is Parliament, and the people who work here for him and for all the other members.
Mr. Speaker, thank you. I will refer back to my letter of 24th of February, and I'd be grateful if you would give indication whether you would give some kind of statement as regards the content of my letter, or is it that you are choosing to ignore it completely?
I may or I may not, because I have considered the hindsight of the meeting, and before the matter reached the stage that which it reached in respect of the acronym involving Mr. Yama, I made a statement. If you care to go back, and I checked with the hindsight. And I know that what I was saying amounted to a defense of Mr. Yama. Because I explained that it wasn't easy for members to arrange their affairs when Parliament meets unexpectedly, and that is the position in which Mr. Yama had found himself, and indeed other members. So I had already defended his position, safeguarded his position, and I said that nothing more should be said about the question of members being absent. There are members absent here this afternoon. So what? So what? I mean, the only one person really that needs to be here, apart from the forum, and that is me. I have no deputy. I am always here. And it would be very difficult, the way that things are in Parliament, for any of the other 17 to sit here and keep matters under reasonable control. I will allow the Honourable Member one last opportunity to speak, and then we are going to move on to the next item.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. But in your view, Mr. Speaker, Standing Order 4512, does it or does it not prohibit the
I need the word. The conduct of members of Parliament shall not be raised. Full stop. I do not consider that what Mr. Yama said amounted to conduct. If anybody from the government criticized him in respect of his conduct, that is not conduct. Conduct is a habitual behavior. Conduct has to do with a way of life. An incident in which an honorable member is absent for one meeting, possibly for very good reasons, that does not amount to the conduct of the member. And therefore, if the chief minister or anybody else criticized him in that respect, in my view, he was not criticizing his conduct. He was criticizing the fact that he hadn't been here for a particular meeting of Parliament. And that is all that I'm going to say. Will you please call the next item, petition?
Petition, announcement, papers to be laid, report of committee, suspension of standing orders, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to move under standing order 7.3 to suspend standing order 7.1 in order to proceed with government bills.
Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
Bills, first and second reading. A bill for an act to make provision for the exercise of emergency powers in accordance with section 18 to B of the Constitution, where a public emergency arises or is likely and for connected purposes. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to make provision for the exercise of emergency powers in accordance with section 18(2)(b) of the Constitution, where a public emergency arises or is likely, and for connected purposes, be read as first time.
I will now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to make provision for the exercise of emergency powers in accordance with section 18(2)(b) of the Constitution, where a public emergency arises or is likely, and for connected purposes, be read a first time. Those in favour? No. Again? Carried.
The Governor's Emergency Powers Act 2017.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill for the Governor's Emergency Powers Act 2017 be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, honourable members will know that section 35(3) of the Constitution provides as follows. Every bill shall be published in the Gazette, and the Parliament shall not proceed upon any bill until the expiration of 6 weeks after the date on which the bill was to be published, unless the Chief Minister certifies by writing under his hand that consideration of the bill is too urgent to permit statutory delay. I have certified this bill as urgent under section 35(3) of the Constitution, Mr. Speaker. I have written to you to this effect, and although I am not required by the Constitution to do so, I've also written to the Leader of the Opposition and the Independent member, Mrs. Hassan Naon, informing them of my certification of the bill as urgent. Mr. Speaker, this bill also engages another part of the Constitution, which requires that Parliament be alert to the manner in which it proceeds today. Section 35(2) of the 2006 Constitution, which establishes this Parliament, which is the one just above the one that allows the certification of urgency, states that, except with the consent of the Governor, acting in his discretion, signified by the Chief Minister, the Parliament shall not proceed upon any bill, including an amendment to any bill, that in the opinion of the Governor, acting in his discretion, signified as aforesaid, concerns a matter for which he is responsible under section 47(1). The Speaker has already indicated to you in writing communication of urgency, and that His Excellency of the Governor, Lieutenant General David Davis, has given his consent as required by section 35(2) of this bill to proceed through the stages in this House. I confirm the same, Speaker, to the Leader of the Opposition and Mrs. Hassan Naon, the Independent member also. Mr. Speaker, turning now to the substance of the bill, I must tell honourable members that I have particular pleasure in bringing this bill to the House, because as the House will know, the exercise by the Governor of powers in an emergency already exists. At present, that power is conferred by the Emergency Powers Order 1939, as amended from time to time. In fact, Mr. Speaker, that order has been amended quite considerably. Amendments range from 1953 to 1973. And That order in counsel, Mr. Speaker, is of direct application in Gibraltar. In other words, a piece of UK law which has a direct effect in Gibraltar. The 1939 order has been on the settled book in the United Kingdom for a long time, and its application was first specifically provided for in the 1969 Constitution. Whilst the 2006 Constitution continues to refer to the 1939 Order in Council, it also provides that, in the alternative, there be any law enacted by the legislature to like effect, which would then have effect in periods of emergency. Mr. Speaker, this bill, if passed by the Parliament, will be that law, that alternative law enacted by this legislature. In order to understand the importance of this rule and the bill that is before the House, Mr. Speaker, we should reflect that there are 11 substantive references to an emergency in the Constitution. As lawyers and constitutional scholars will know, the words "an emergency" are usually used to defeat the application of fundamental rights that are protected in a constitution. One must always, therefore, be very careful when dealing with situations in which we would accept the application of a provision that defeats or blunts the application of the constitutional rights which form the framework of our laws. So, in these circumstances, before bringing to the Parliament a bill, the government would be very circumspect indeed to understand that we are not in any way creating any powers which would be potentially used to be set to defeat fundamental constitutional rights. Those rights could be the rights of individuals in the chapter of fundamental human rights, or they could equally be the rights of the homegrown institutions of Gibraltar created by or under the Constitution, which may somehow be suspended or have their powers curtailed in the relevant applicable circumstances. Mr. Speaker, we on the government side are satisfied that this Act will not curtail such individual or institutional rights in any material way for reasons that will become apparent. In other words, Mr. Speaker, there is no derogation of any powers which the government may now hold and exercise by the passing by this Parliament of the Governor's Emergency Powers Act. Let us also, before going any further, look at where the references in the Constitution are to the 1939 Order in Council and to emergencies generally. Principally, Mr. Speaker, sections 17, 18, 45, and 78 of the Constitution contain these references. The original reference is in section 17.1, a section that provides for periods of public emergency. And section 17.1 says this: "Nothing contained in or done under the authority of any regulation made under the Emergency Powers Order in Council 1939, or any law enacted by the legislature," and Mr. Speaker, that means this legislature, it doesn't mean the UK Parliament, it means this legislature, the word legislature appears capitalized and is therefore subject to the definition of legislature in the Constitution. So any law enacted by the legislature to like effect shall be held to be inconsistent with or in contravention of section 3, section 4.2, or any provision of section 7, 9, 10, 11, or 12, section 13, 1, or 3, or section 14, to the extent that the regulation or law in question makes in relation to any period of public emergency provision, or authorizes the doing so during such a period of anything to the extent strictly required by the exigencies of the situation arising or existing during that period for the purpose of dealing with that situation. Mr. Speaker, all of those sections referred to in section 17 are sections that deal with individual rights protected under the Fundamental Human Rights chapter of our Constitution. Mr. Speaker, section 18 sets out when an emergency is deemed to have occurred under the Constitution, and I'll deal with section 18 in greater detail later in my address when I'm dealing with the substantive provisions of the bill before the House. Section 45 of our Constitution is in particular relevant when there is an election on foot in Gibraltar. In fact, Mr. Speaker, it's important that we look at that section in its interplay with this bill, because that will indicate to honourable members just how important this bill is. Section 45.9 of our Constitution provides that under the dissolution of the Parliament, the Chief Minister and ministers in office at the time of such a dissolution shall remain in office and shall discharge their functions until new elections are held and a chief minister appointed in accordance with the constitution following such election. But such executive authority may not be exercised, and this is an important parenthesis in the future, save in the event of public emergency, including public order or safety, to commit a binding action of the government of Gibraltar to public funding or liability, except in the ordinary course of the day-to-day affairs of Gibraltar. So in other words, because once an election is called, say, Section 45(9) of the Constitution bites, there is still a chief minister, there are still ministers, but we can't engage spending other than immediately required, in respect of which there might be any commitment, unless there's an emergency. And those are the types of situations that we're dealing with here. It is important to reflect, Mr. Speaker, that in such an emergency being declared, the Constitution is not suspended. So neither does cabinet government. We're not dealing with the suspension of the Constitution and the United Kingdom taking power, something that we saw in most recent constitutional history in the Turks and Caicos Islands. Neither are we seeing the Constitution remaining the cabinet government being suspended. We are seeing a situation where there is an emergency, but the Constitution is still in place and cabinet government is still active. And in that context, Mr. Speaker, what we're going to do with this afternoon creates powers which are complementary to the powers of cabinet government, Speaker. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, the reality is that the declaration of an emergency will, in effect, in such circumstances, allow the government, through the governor, to take extraordinary measures for the purposes set out in the bill. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, there are other acts in our statute which are relevant, which I'll come to in a moment. Section 78(5) of the Constitution sets out that references in this Constitution to the Emergency Powers Order in Council 1939, which is the one I'm referring to the House, are references to that order as from time to time amended and include references to any order or other law replacing that order in relation to Gibraltar. It's important, Mr. Speaker, that honourable members keep that in mind. You see, Mr. Speaker, in order for this Parliament to legislate in this field, the 1939 order in council must cease to apply. In that regard, today, we draw the Parliament's attention to the Emergency Powers Overseas Territories Order 2017, which is set to instrument 181 of this year of the United Kingdom Parliament, and which comes into operation on the 16th of March this year. That is to say, Mr. Speaker, next Thursday. That order, Mr. Speaker, was made on the 15th of February and was laid before Parliament as recently as the 22nd of February. And for that reason, Mr. Speaker, we've not been able to publish our own bill, which is the localised version of that order, that new modernised order, and so last week, although we've been doing a lot of work with UK colleagues, but of course the order in the UK has not crystallised until laid and published. Mr. Speaker, the new order in council will have the effect of replacing the 1939 order with a regime that is substantially the same in effect, albeit with some modernization. The relevance of the 2017 order in council is that it will not apply to Gibraltar, but only once this bill becomes an act and is in operation. Article 1.2b of the 2017 order in council made in the UK a week ago provides that order extends to Gibraltar, but only to the limited extent provided for in Article 3.3 of the order itself. And Article 3.3 of the order states this: in relation to Gibraltar, the instruments specified in Schedule 2 that apply to Gibraltar are revoked with effect from the date that equivalent provision comes into force. Equivalent provision being the reference that is made earlier, Mr. Speaker, that is in the Constitution, in our Constitution. Mr. Speaker, therefore, what honourable members will want to know is that this bill, once it is an act passed by this Parliament, will be that equivalent provision which will obviate the need for the application of the new order in council to Gibraltar. It is therefore, Mr. Speaker, the government's intention that if the bill is passed by the Parliament today, the Act should receive assent and and be published before the 16th of March. In that way, I'm observing that chronology, Mr. Speaker, the 2017 order in Council will not ever have applied to Gibraltar. Honourable members will know, Mr. Speaker, that there is a convention since the 2006 Constitution that the United Kingdom does not extend the application of orders in Council to Gibraltar, although it has the right to do so. The provisions of the new Emergency Powers Order in Council must nonetheless be provided for in order to ensure that there is constitutional completeness. In the circumstances, we're now providing that constitutional completeness via this homegrown Gibraltar Parliament Act. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, in terms of constitutional theory, what this Act will do is ensure a closing of the circle in respect of emergency powers in a way that is entirely homegrown. To summarise all of that constitutional backdrop for honourable members in non-legal and understandable plain English, Speaker, I'll put it like this. The government is an emanation of the Gibraltar Constitution. This Parliament is an emanation of the Gibraltar Constitution. And now, with this act, Mr. Speaker, with this bill, if it becomes an act, the powers that the governor would enjoy in an emergency will also be powers granted by an institution which is created by the Constitution. In every way, therefore, we're localizing the grant of powers that would be operating in the context of a declaration of emergency by the governor. We are granting the governor those powers, Mr. Speaker. The granted powers are created by the UK Order in Council, either 1939 order or the 2017 order, would be obviated, as I said before, by the granted powers by this legislature. It is important that we put into context what I've just taken the House through and in what circumstances an emergency could be declared and what it would amount to. The Speaker, Section 18 of the Constitution provides for the interpretation of its provisions, and with respect to emergency, it defines them thus. In this chapter, a period of emergency means any period in which Her Majesty is at war, or B, the provisions of Part 2 of the Emergency Powers Order in Council in 1939 by an operation in Gibraltar, or any emergency has been declared under any law enacted by the legislature to right effect. Declarations of war not being the subject of the bill, Mr. Speaker, Clause 3.1 provides for there to be a public emergency when declared pursuant to the Act. Such a declaration is made by the Governor, issuing a proclamation to that effect. But a proclamation may only be made where the circumstances set out in Clause 2.2 apply, that is to say, an event or situation threatening serious damage to human welfare in Gibraltar, whether in whole or in part, an event or situation threatening serious damage to the environment of Gibraltar, whether in whole or in part, or an event or situation threatening serious damage to the security of Gibraltar. The power to make the proclamation of emergency is then set out in Clause 4. And unless a shorter period is specified or a proclamation is earlier revoked, the proclamation lapses after 30 days, although a new proclamation can be made pursuant to Subclause 3. And Subclause 5 requires that any proclamation of emergency made under the section shall be published in the Gazette as soon as practicable after it is made. But, Mr. Speaker, I think it's important that all the members have in mind that the proclamation and the declaration of the emergency do not suspend the Constitution. What they do is they allow for things to be done which might otherwise be caught by certain sections of the Constitution, which are the sections of which the House approved before. A regulation making power is provided for also, which is the basis for action to be taken following the issue of a proclamation for public emergency, and this power is provided for in Clause 5. Such powers are, however, to be exercised where specific conditions are met only, and those are the ones set out in Clause 6. And require that the provision is necessary for the purpose of preventing, controlling, or mitigating an aspect or effect of the state of public emergency in respect of which regulations are made, that the effect of the provision is proportionate to that aspect or effect of the state of public emergency, and the need for the provision is urgent. It's very unusual to ask for ways to be given in the context of this part of the speech. I think it's probably better for the gentleman to raise the issue in the context of his opportunity to question me and to involve certain reasons.
The reason why we do this is that it is important that
That is why I think he left his teachings to finish is the point that the chief he wishes to have clarification of is not covered by the chief minister. Then he can raise the matter and invite the chief minister there and then by giving way to reply. That is the proper conduct. I think it's not a very customary thing to ask anybody moving a second reading of a bill to give way. It never happened.
I have been in that side of the house.
It's never happened during the time that I've been in the chair.
It has happened when I have been a government minister. I have also been a government minister. Mr. Speaker, unfortunately, often forgets that. So I've been a government minister. And I have given way from that side of the house. It is true, Mr. Speaker, you're absolutely right, that of course it can be done the other way. And of course it will defer to Mr. Speaker. But to say that it never happened, that quickly, in my own experience, is not the case.
It's very unusual for that to happen. And given the memory that I have, I do recall that the Honourable Member has been a minister of the government from 2007 to 2011. Am I correct?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, you're correct.
Thank you.
Yes. All the member of parties used to belong to as well. One often wonders how why is it the opposition spend more time opposing the Speaker than the government. Anyway, Mr. Speaker, I may deal with issues that the Honourable Gentleman wants clarified in what is left of my address, otherwise I'd be happy to deal with them in the context of my response, Mr. Speaker. The limitations, Mr. Speaker, are imposed on the scope of the regulations that can be made, and in particular, the Act, of course, specifically provides that anything done by regulation by the governor when a proclamation of emergency is extant does not allow for the constitution to be amended. And this is an important point. One could argue that the clause is unnecessary, as a law created by this legislature cannot give power to amend the constitution which created this legislature, but I think it is important to remain in because it imputes into the bill the clarity that the constitution is not suspended at that point. The constitution is active and current at that point. Clause 8 creates offences for breaches of regulations made under Clause 5 and Clause 9 provides supremacy over other enactments should there be any inconsistencies. And Clause 10 imposes discretion on the governor and exercising powers conferred under the bill. However, Mr. Speaker, Clause 2 specifically provides that so far as it is practicable to do so, the governor shall consult the chief minister. Mr. Speaker, the practicability here is the essential aspect. It may not be practicable to consult because of communications being impossible between the chief minister and the governor in such eventuality. It may not be practicable for a host of reasons which is kind of in that state. If it is practicable, however, then consultation must occur. Mr. Speaker, the House will know that the Civil Contingency Act 2007 is the flip side of the coin and confers powers which are not dissimilar to those we are dealing with here, but not powers that relate to security. That act goes further in the establishment of structures such as the Civil Contingency Committee and the Civil Contingency Coordinator Post is created. This act, Mr. Speaker, will however be relevant in an instance where the structures and powers set out under the Civil Contingency Laws are sometimes potentially not operable. In a situation where a complete breakdown of our institutions could have occurred. This act creates an avenue for action which does not require the suspension of the constitution or the cessation of cabinet government, but enables action to be taken or start to be taken in order to re-establish the needs of civil society. Mr. Speaker, making this bill an act, we will in effect be bringing into the purview of this House the final piece of the judicial outstanding in respect of the internal architecture of the current 2006 Constitution. No power which has been granted to the government of devolved under that Constitution is in any way diminished by this bill. We would not have brought the bill if it did. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, we are in effect becoming masters of our own destiny, even in an emergency, as even in that eventuality. All the actors will remain creatures of this Constitution, and all the powers exercised will emanate from it and its institutions, the most important one being the Parliament itself, as we create the powers within the bill. Mr. Speaker, all of those reasons are commended to the bill to the House, and I look forward to dealing with any of the honourable members of the debate.
This thought I'd put the question, as many of our members to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill. The Honourable Mr. Clinton.
Thank you. I'm grateful to the Chief Minister for his explanation and analysis of the fairly comprehensive piece of legislation, and is obviously being tabled on an urgent basis. I'm not much of an historian, as perhaps Dr. The Deputy Chief Minister is, more than amateur historian. If I recall correctly, 1931, which is obviously the period when the Regional Ordering Council was still in place, the City Council itself was suspended, and the government then appointed one individual to exercise powers in respect of civilians by himself. I've heard the Chief Minister say that the Constitution is not suspended, and I will carry on as normal, as it can be in the circumstances, and that the cabinet governments will carry on. Well, my question to you is, well, what happens to this place? I mean, does Parliament continue to meet? Is Parliament de facto suspended? Will we continue to pass laws? Or is it just held in suspense? In which case, is this de facto, and it happened all the world over, a bill for introducing martial law? It is a fairly serious matter, and I don't think it's something that we can not discuss, or at least have some discussion about this. I understand the reasons for it. I understand that the government will probably have the power to do this in any case. And by codifying it in our own legislation, we also avoid it having been imposed upon us. But really, to meet with an understanding of the parliamentarian as to what our role would be under this Act. Will Parliament continue to sit monthly? Will we be able to pass laws? What is it that the role this particular chamber will perform? Or is it just the cabinet that will continue to meet and try to run civilian government as best as it can? And as I say, you know, I'm just looking from the point of view of historical precedent, where in 1939 or thereabouts, the City Council itself was suspended. And I believe the powers were vested in a few major patrons, if I may say again. But Dr. Joseph, the Field Deputy Chief Minister, will no doubt be able to confirm or not. Yeah? And that is really what I am trying to understand what this bill will do in terms of the wider context of this Parliament. I'd be grateful if the Chief Minister may as well respond to the just that. Thank you, Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, may I please wait for the bill? I will then call.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Historian, the Deputy Chief Minister reminded me that the City Council was suspended in January 1941. There was a little something going on then, which was called the Second World War. I have no doubt that the Emergency Powers Ordering Council, given that it was dated 1939, may have been related to the planning that Great Britain was doing about what it would do around the world in respect of war. And in fact, the first opportunity to declare an emergency in the definition set out is if there is a war. But as I told the Parliament, we're dealing with that sort of situation, but I will deal with it in the context of my reply. So in 1941, I understand all powers were taken by the government. But the procedure in 1941 was a different time, and absent of the issue of war, there was also no constitution in the building that granted powers to a parliament. We're dealing with the City Council, it was a municipality, and indeed, as the Honourable Historian reminds me, all the personnel in Gibraltar that were not able to join the war effort were evacuated from Gibraltar. So you think of that was a concept which may indeed have theoretically the possibility of arising again, because it will never happen, but the figure there is a difference between a situation where a constitution is suspended and where emergency powers are being taken. Now, the honourable member asked me, does this parliament continue to meet? Well, Mr. Speaker, this parliament might continue to meet, but we don't know whether it would be possible for this parliament to continue to meet. What he needs to understand, in the context of what I have said, is that I've already told the House that the constitution continues in place. And if you look at the powers granted to the governor in this instance, they are powers that relate principally to the suspension of personal liberty. So, nowhere in the context of what is set out in the provision is the legislature or the executive in any way curtailed. In other words, Section 24 to 43 of the Parliament, Section 40 of the Constitution, sorry, which creates the Parliament, and Section 44 to 53 are not where the grab occurs. The grab occurs in respect of personal liberty. In other words, protecting from slavery or forced or compulsory labor, which is Section 4, the right to personal liberty, the protection of the freedom of expression, the protection of the freedom of assembly and association, the protection of the freedom to establish schools, and the protection of the freedom of movement, and the protection of discrimination on grounds of racism. And those are the clauses that are actually engaged, so to speak. In other words, those are the ones where, looking at it in stark terms, things can be done in that situation which may, in another time, offend those sections, but in that time may be necessary. And so, Mr. Speaker, this is not a suspension of the Parliament. The Parliament, Mr. Speaker, is based on personal membership of the legislature by individuals who happen to stand in political parties. Political parties exist because you have the freedom of association. The freedom of association might be suspended. But even in our most revolutionary moments, Mr. Speaker, I don't think we have done anything that might warrant emergency powers being taken. I think, Mr. Speaker, in a situation where there might be war, the first parenthesis, or the second parenthesis, those emergencies, something will have happened which might, at another time, have offended those parts of the Constitution. But the Parliament is not one of the things that is stopped from meeting. Now, but it may be that the Parliament might not meet. Now, we've seen that the Parliament meets every month since we were elected, except when the referendum was called, and we've seen times not of war and not of emergency, where the Parliament has met twice in a particular year. Three times in a particular year, which is what the Constitution provides for. So the government might not be able to come to Parliament, either because of indisposition or because if there's an emergency on, you might all agree that we don't want to come to Parliament. We want to deal with the emergency. The important thing is that the Constitution is not suspended. That's why it's necessary to say those parts of the Constitution will not have the effect that they have in peacetime, because the Constitution continues in place. The powers of the legislature under the Constitution continue to have effect, and the powers of executive government under the Constitution continue to have effect. And so, Mr. Speaker, you could not be further from a declaration of martial law, which is what the Honourable Gentleman has suggested to me this might be doing. This is not martial law. I think you're going to need to understand what martial law is. You could not have martial law and the Constitution alongside each other. You would have to suspend the Constitution, because it would be a very strange martial law indeed that allowed us to come here and say that we're right about the martial assuming that we were not the ones declaring martial law, which of course we couldn't be because we don't have an army. The only people who have an army and who have the constitutional responsibility in respect of the raising of an army and security are the United Kingdom. And the powers that have been given to the government by this legislature could not be powered to empower the governor in respect of the army. And so, Speaker, nothing could be further from what this bill will do if it becomes an act from the declaration of martial law. The only government that is secure, that although we may not see eye to eye on many things, if I was asked to move a bill to allow for martial law, I'd state it in the context of my address. I wouldn't pretend to hide such a thing because, as a civil libertarian, I would want people to be aware that I have been asked to bring a bill to the Parliament, and I assume asked also to convince my then colleagues to raise their arms at the right moment in order to support it, and that would be something I would not agree with. Mr. Speaker, the provisions of the state do not do that. They would not be enjoying the support of the government if they did do that. But the Honourable Gentleman might also know that, of course, it is open to a British government to declare martial law in Gibraltar or in any other territory, and even the United Kingdom. I think that has been shown historically to be anathema to the British system of democracy, and that is why that is one of the many strands of the affinity that the people of Gibraltar have to British democracy, the most mature and established democracy in the history of the planet. But it could happen, and in Gibraltar it would take effect by the simple suspension of the constitution. And the United Kingdom has not been shy to suspend constitutions. It suspended the constitution of the Church and Faith Italian because of financial irregularity, Mr. Speaker. And so, therefore, that is not something that would be dealt with in the context of emergency powers such as this. Now, what sorts of instances would we be dealing with? It's very difficult to imagine, Mr. Speaker, that there would really be instances related principally to natural disasters. There might be instances related to other types of eventualities that make transport communication and all the rest of it almost impossible. Although cabinet government is not suspended, it might be impossible for cabinet government to operate in the way that it tends to do with cabinet meetings every week, etc. Although one is almost tempted to say that we have the suspension of cabinet government before, by these meetings we haven't met with the cabinet, I guess, and as one might have expected them to, but that's for a separate discussion. And in this instance, Mr. Speaker, in my view, because of the quasi-parallel civil contingency provision, in my view, what we are really dealing with is that although government and executive authority is not suspended, although constitution is not suspended, it is not possible to do things in Gibraltar in order to re-establish Gibraltar, and things have to be done for Gibraltar, but they are done through the offices created in the Gibraltar Constitution, which is how we would all like to see it happen, and the proclamation and the period of proclamation is as short as is possible, therefore the 30 days is shorter period, and the extension only by a further 30 days as is provided for, so that the operation of cabinet government is re-established as quickly as possible, and the executive authority is re-established as quickly as possible. So I would say to the Honourable Member opposite, I mean, that what you're seeing in this bill is the work, the groundwork for the opposite of martial law. In other words, the groundwork for the ability to once again govern ourselves after an emergency as soon as possible. And Speaker, for all of those reasons, I think this is a bill that the House should approve. And in particular, I would draw to the attention of the Honourable Gentleman the dates I gave him. The English Order in Council will apply in all the overseas territories from the 16th of March. I think it is in the interest of all members of the Council that we demonstrate that once the trigger of the repeal of the 1939 order has been pressed by the United Kingdom, we move as quickly as possible to ensure that we act in this Parliament to prevent a new order in Council taking effect on the 16th of March here by making this bill an act. Speaking against before the 16th of March and publication and promulgation before the 9th for all of those reasons, Mr. Speaker, hoping I've dealt with many of the gentlemen as clearly as fully as I could on my feet, I commend the bill to
him. I suggest to the Chief Minister that he might talk as to what exactly happened during the Second World War. The civilians that remained behind, surely they were not subject to military law in respect of any offences which they may have committed against. of a civil nature, traffic offences and so on, they weren't subject to military law. Were the courts still in Gibraltar? Was there no chief justice in Gibraltar even in the Second World War? I think this is a matter that can be easily looked into, surely.
I'm sure, Mr. Speaker, I'm sure, and that Mr. Speaker is confirming in the way that he postulates the question that this sort of order, the 1939 order, is the first emanation, which is the modern version, which is good to become the fact, does not have the effect of suspending a constitution, although then there wasn't a constitution to suspend. Of course, there were courts, there were institutions, etc., and those that could continue to function would continue to function, and the effect of the order in council was not to suspend them. And in fact, I'm just being reminded by the Honourable Deputy Minister, the Doctor, at that time, was actively involved in the presentation before tribunals that continued in effect with the system.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to make provision for the exercise of emergency powers in accordance with Section 18(2)(b) of the Constitution, where a public emergency arises or is likely and for connected purposes, be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Governing Emergency Powers Act 2017.
I think I beg to give notice that the political statement for reading of the bill be taken today with all honourable members agreeing, and speak that no other bill will be dealt with today in this
court. All honourable members agree that the committee statement for reading of this bill be taken today.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the House should resolve its present committee to consider the following bill, called by clause, the Governor's Emergency Powers Act 2017.
A bill for an act to make provisions for the exercise of emergency powers in accordance with Section 18(2)(b) of the Constitution, where a public emergency arises or is likely, and for connected purposes. Clauses 1 to 10. Stand part of the bill. Stand part of the bill.
We have the answer report that the Governor's Emergency Powers Act 2017 has been considered in committee and agreed to without amendment, and I now move that it be read a third time and passed.
I now put a question, which is that the Governor's Emergency Powers Act 2017 be read a third time and passed. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
Mr. Speaker, late in the Friday afternoon, and the cusp of a long weekend, having read this morning, by the way, in the time by Congress to serve in the House, but today is the day that clock commenced in London, I have the honour to move that the House will now adjourn to Friday the 17th of May at March 1st at 2:30 p.m.
I now put a question, and I'll propose a question, that the House will now adjourn Friday, the 17th of March at 2:30 in the afternoon. I now put the question, which is that the House do now adjourn to next Friday, the 17th of March at 2:30 in the afternoon. Those in favour? Those against? The House will now adjourn to next Friday at 2:30 in the afternoon.